Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Leadership and Management Book Podcast. I'm here with my great friend, Wally Bach. We're doing something we both love to do, which is talking about books. Hey, Wally.
Yeah, talking about books is almost as much fun as reading books. And hanging out with you is always fun because we dish dirt that we don't share with everybody else.
There we go. Hey, I appreciate that. I'm not sure everyone thinks the same way. I don't think my old team members thought hanging out with me was all that much fun, but I appreciate that someone does. So, you know, today's theme is books that we like to reread. And I really love that. You came up with this idea. I'm a chronic rereader of certain books. It may very well be because I'm not all that bright and it takes me a few times through to get it. But there are just some I like to go back to over and over again. And it was funny because you've got kind of that same thinking. So,
well, I believe that you can't get the full value from a great book if you only read it once. That's one reason to reread, just because there's too much in books like some of the ones we're going to talk about today to get it all at one time. The other thing is that your circumstances change. It's like that Heraclitus saying you can't step into the same river twice because the river is always moving. I've been reading one of the books we're going to talk about today, The Effective Executive, since about, I would say, 1968 or 1969. And I am in it at least once a week. And I have reread it enough times that I wore out three paperback books before I got wise to do it a Kindle book. So you reread because you get more the second time, I think. And that's part of the whole deal.
Yeah, more the second, the third, the fourth. You know, I've started to develop some hacks using technology to try to do a better job the first time through. And I think you and I compared notes one time. I do a lot of my business book reading on a Kindle app, on an iPad, on a tablet. And I capture, I annotate, I highlight, I capture notes. I use the flashcard function. That's something you do as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and flashcards is one of the ways that I review books. There's a lot of books that I won't go all the way through again. I don't need to read The Power of Full Engagement a second time. But going back to the notes that I made reminds me of important things. I used to do that with index cards. I mean, I put the page number and a little note that would tell me what
sure,
to do.
Yeah.
Now I do what you do. It's on Kindle. I use the flashcards to review. I share the notes on Goodreads,
right,
which helps people who read my reviews see a little bit of my thinking. And I think it's a boon for those of us who read professional books.
Yeah. No, I agree with you there. But what we're talking about here today is something deeper. We're not just reviewing flashcards. We're going back into, and I'll use that term that only people who read Stranger in a Strange Land in the 60s and 70s know. Well, you really want to try to grok what the author is thinking and writing about, right? You know, we're rereading it. So why don't you kick us off with that? And you mentioned Peter Drucker, The Effective Executive. Why do you go at this one over and over?
I go at it, first of all, I think it is the best business book I've ever read, period. When I read it, there weren't many good business books. Most books were like by the former chairman of AT&T, and it was written like an academic treatise, and it was long, and it had lots of compound complex sentences with multiple commas. And Drucker wrote like a journalist. He wrote nice, clean prose, but more to the point, you know, there I am. I'm out of the Marines. I'm going to work. I've tried reading stuff that my professors suggest, and it isn't doing it for me. And I picked this book up, and I read it the first time in the night.
Wow.
And I went back to work. I was working while I was getting my degree. So I went back to work the next day, and I actually started applying stuff that he said in the very first chapter, which is about know your time and managing your time. So from there, the thing that impresses me about Drucker is that he is right about so many things that are eternal. We've still got to manage time today.
Right.
We've still got to, you know, how do you measure output and work? Still got to do that. We've still got to work with other people. We've still got to make decisions. And he's got good advice on that. So I've been rereading it probably in full 10 or 12 times. And certainly once a week for something, I'll pick it up or fire up the Kindle and look at the that one or two, what do I want to say, phrases or sections. So
from your enthusiastic advocacy for Drucker in the book, I suspect you're thinking Drucker has aged well. It's been quite a long time since he wrote that book, and of course we lost
book, it. The book was copyrighted in 1966.
Right.
So it's 52 years, 53 years, yeah. 4 years. I can't do math, but I can read Drucker.
So would you counsel young professionals in the workplace to pick up this circa 1960s management book and read it today?
Yes, I would. Not any 1960s management book. This particular one is a great book to read because what's in it hasn't changed. Some of the language has changed. I mean, he's writing in 1966. There's no inclusive language.
Right.
He's talking about managers and management. If you were writing today, it might be leadership and leaders because that language has moved a little bit. Most of the examples were very familiar to me when I read it the first time and still are, but they're not going to be familiar to my son, for example, right, who's 40, or to people much younger than that. But it's you'll still get from the book, you'll get enough, and that's why you do it.
You know, one of the things I've always been impressed with on Drucker, he was so far ahead of his time in identifying the rise of the knowledge worker and the implications of that shift in our economy and in our organizations and what that meant for management and managers. That's the one thing that comes at me over and over again with Drucker's work.
Yeah, and he did that in the 50s.
Yeah.
When he talked about how the post-World War II GI Bill was the thing that was going to change our society because it would make knowledge work common. It would make degrees common. And there you have it.
Sure. You know, I've always been a big fan of Dr. Gary Hamel's, and his theme has been for a long time that management must be reinvented. My reading of Drucker and his concepts were that he was actually beating the same drum consistently.
I think that's a good point. I think they both essentially say the same thing. What I've taken about Hamel, who I also revere, is what he's talking about is changing the language more than necessarily the good practice.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Drucker created the language.
Yes.
Hamel says to do this right, we need to change it some.
Yeah, good. Kind of a good comparison contrast. If I were writing a college paper on management, I might take that up. So, you know, kudos to anybody who grabs that out there. Share it with us. I'll run it on the blog. And I have to ask you a personal question here. When you were describing those complex compound sentences with a lot of commas,
yeah,
are you describing my writing style, Wally? Because I resemble
No, actually, Art, much as it hates me to say this in public, you write pretty well. I have just read a book that will be nameless for right now, where that's exactly what happens. In the early part of the book, that author wrote a paragraph-long sentence.
Oh, nice.
67 words, 7 commas.
Nice.
Telling us what the book was going to be about. I should have known then that it was time to close the covers, but I didn't.
Channeling their inner Faulkner there, yeah, minimizing punctuation and period.
Hey, Faulkner was doing stories and stream of consciousness, and I'll go reread Faulkner any day.
Yeah.
But don't try to talk to me about management and leadership and stuff that business people do and make it compound or complex or just not.
So any closing thoughts on Peter Drucker, The Effective Executive, one of your most reread books?
Yeah, reread it.
Okay, just to cap it off.
Here's one small thing that's really neat when you go back to a book like Drucker's. Understand, I read this, my father-in-law read it. One of the first ways that we really connected was that he handed me a book and he said, this is a book you'll really like. I said, well, I've already read that 3 or 4 times. It was, oh, good. Because it's spoken to a lot of people over time because of that and because of the electronic stuff, you now have lots of highlights of other people. Mm-hmm. You have a couple of generations worth that you can look at.
Sure, sure. Great, great. All right, so I'm going to kick off with one, and it's a topic that's been important to me in my career. It's a genre of books in the business world, strategy books. And, you know, Wally, at the end of my life, I would like all the time back that I spent reading most of the strategy books that I've ever encountered, except for this one and maybe one or two others out there. And I'm talking about one we both share an interest in, that is Good Strategy, Bad Strategy by Richard P. Rumelt. This is my single favorite book on strategy ever because of its simplicity and the power in its simplicity for what Rumelt does. He lays out this basic definition of strategy. He highlights that most of what passes for strategy out there in the world is anything but. And he gives us a construct, the kernel of a strategy, with three components to it. The diagnosis, what the heck is going on here? That's what the diagnosis is all about. A guiding policy, what are we going to do about it? And coherent actions, and says that every good strategy has this component, these three components in the kernel. And he goes on, he's also a historian, and he uses great examples from history. I think he's a deep management thinker, and I wouldn't be shocked to imagine that he was a devotee of Drucker as well. And he just makes one of these, this concept of strategy, which is so confusing to so many, he makes it comprehensible, and more importantly, he makes it actionable. And you know, I reread it over and over again in anticipation of heading out to strategy engagements. If I'm going to go out and help a client facilitate or develop a strategy or advise on it, I'll come back to Rumelt, I'll read the book, I'll refresh on his examples, and I'll try and absolutely, with attribution, incorporate his concepts into the process. And I can tell you, since I've been using his material, the quality and the effectiveness of the strategy engagements has gone up materially. I have clients that actually get what strategy is, management teams that are on the same page with it, and so forth. So in case you can't tell, I'm really enthusiastic about Good Strategy, Bad Strategy.
Yeah, and as you said, we both like it, but you didn't mention that I read it because you recommended it.
I did not, yeah. And you wrote quite a nice review on it, very thoughtful review.
Yeah. For me, one of the important things about that book is that it gives people a way to judge a strategy. Mm-hmm. So it's not just how you create one yourself. It's, right. Okay, you wander into a new organization or a new team, and they tell you their strategy, and you can learn and say, okay, okay, what's the kernel here? And
yeah, what's really
you can
going
figure
on?
It out.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, what's really going on, which is the big thing. The other thing I like about it is, like almost all of the great business books I've read, they take something that other people have made complex. We were just joking about that.
Yeah.
And give you a simple framework to sort it out. And I thought that was, it's moved right into my pantheon since you recommended it and I read it.
Good deal. So, good deal. Yeah, and I have more than a few clients. I probably should be getting a royalty from Rumelt because I have more than a few clients that have acquired this book and have kept it on the bookshelves and pull it out.
Either that or he should be charging you a fee.
Shh, don't say that, Wally. Don't give him any ideas. So just as an aside for those out there that are interested, managers and executives in books on strategy, the other one that I actually like a lot is Your Strategy Needs a Strategy. And that highlights some key frameworks and actually really digestible. And I like to pair those two together. I suppose if you forced me, I'll have to throw Jeffrey Moore's Escape Velocity into the grouping of books I really love that tie to strategy. And you know, beyond that, I want that time back, Wally.
Yeah, and I think Moore's interesting because so much of what he said has been absorbed into other people.
Yeah.
That you don't realize how original he was when he wrote for the first time.
The Chasm, Inside the Tornado, they're classics and they're certainly worth the time. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. So So that's my first one. We heard from you on Peter Drucker, The Effective Executive. What's the second book that you like to reread?
My second book, and you and I have talked about this, and you have a slightly different take on it, so we'll share that in a minute. The other book that I picked for this is High Output Management by Andy Grove. And I liked it when I read it originally. I went back and picked it up, actually after I had reread Drucker about 5 years ago. And I was thinking, what other books should I be looking at? And I found it absolutely fascinating a second time, even given the changes in language. He's talking about management. I can see people reading it today and say, well, what about leadership? Well, what about leadership? Let's just read the damn book. Okay. The thing that I like most about it is the focus on middle managers, because so many books are aimed at CEOs and C-suite executives. Middle managers, you evaluate them by evaluating the output of their teams. That's the only way that you can do that. And the way that you support middle managers is to help them help their teams do better. So, I mean, all of things near and dear to my heart. I was amazed, given the difference between when it was published and when I read it, that it was still as relevant as it was. So it was great for me. But you were saying a little bit earlier that you reread it and it wasn't such a hot deal for you.
Yeah, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking a little bit. And first of all, I agree with your premise on middle managers and the output. And in fact, I'm, as you know from my writing, I'm passionate about the role that middle managers play in, you know, innovation, collaboration, driving results, bringing strategy to life. I mean, frankly, they're the ones that are the connective tissue between those lofty ideas coming from the C-suite and the people on the front line. So, and you know, I suppose I got caught up a little bit in feeling like it was a 1960s or 70s management class. And maybe I was just being a little too snobby about my thinking about it. So you've got me rethinking my perspective. I struggle.
Well, now I'm wondering, what did I miss? Mark didn't like it. Come on.
I struggled to read it and I didn't finish it for the second time. So it's not making my list of books I want to reread, but doesn't mean that people shouldn't.
Well, it was published the first time in 1983.
Okay, that's
so.
Okay.
All right, but I know what you mean, because every author like this is publishing stuff he's been thinking about for the previous 10 years. But I suggest if people want to pick this up, take a look inside the book as Amazon lets you.
Right.
And the new edition has I think it's a foreword, I'm not sure, by Ben Horowitz.
Yeah, right.
And that will tell you why he liked it. And that may be enough to get you to pick up the book or not, rather than Art or Wally.
I think that Ben Horowitz actually funded the reprint of it. He brought it back into print, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know that that's true, but it sure could be.
I believe
he's enthusiastic enough about it. He mentions it several times in his book, in his first book.
And, you know, I want to give, I certainly loved Andy Grove, and I liked Only the Paranoid Survive a lot when that came out. That was his following book. But here's what I'm really impressed with. Andy Grove thought so highly and so critically of the importance of managers and management development that not only did he train constantly, he wrote a book and gave it to his management there. And that impresses me. What a great leadership lesson that is.
There's a lot of Andy Grove leadership lessons. We haven't seen a good biography of Andy Grove. And I think somebody needs to write it. And somebody who's both a talented writer and has access to some of the people who were part of the whole thing. But, I mean, you're talking about somebody who's a refugee who didn't speak English and wound up with a PhD. You find thinking of his in articles and quotes of his that you read that other people remember. And for somebody who's not an author per se, he has an immense amount of influence on the way we think, even if we don't know it.
So am I mixing up my books here? I know he, I believe he was covered in The Strategists, which talks about himself, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates. And wasn't he in Isaac's, featured in Isaacson's book as well, The Innovators?
Yes, he is. He's featured in The Innovators.
Yeah.
I don't know about The Strategists. That's,
I'm
not familiar enough with that, but he is in The Innovators. Yeah. With all the rest of those people.
Yes, exactly. So no great individual biography. All right, so there we've got it from you. A great recommendation from a fascinating and impactful individual, Andy Grove's High Output Management. So I've got one that, unfortunately, too many people have never heard of before, and it's from an individual who I'm surprised isn't more visible. I'm biased because I've taken classes with Lee Thompson, Professor Thompson, over at Northwestern. I think she's remarkable. She writes and teaches and does extensive research in the world of team development, negotiation, and creativity. And this book, Creative Conspiracy, The New Rules of Breakthrough Collaboration, not sure I love the title, but oh my gosh, it's 265 pages of good research-backed guidance on how to promote creativity and how to lead ideation. And she tackles the myths that we have about creativity. And she runs through, I think in the first chapter, a dozen or so statements. And she said, look, most people will agree with 75% of the statements I just made. It turns out that research says they're all false. One of the ones that jumps out at you is teams are better at generating ideas than individuals. Well, all of the research suggests that the nominal group approach or individuals basically exceed that of the team. Yet there are techniques you can use to strengthen the performance of teams. And she takes this research-backed content and distills it down to some to-dos. And, you know, I guess there's a theme in my books here that I reread again. When I'm going to work with a client, sometimes on a strategy engagement, other whatever purposes, and there's going to be an ideation component in there of some form, I reread Creative Conspiracy. And I think just about every manager out there who's running brainstorm sessions, and that's all of you, by the way, for everyone listening, who's running some form of brainstorming or ideation or is dependent upon ideas to come up to solve problems, improve processes, to innovate more effectively, you need to read Lee Thompson's Creative Conspiracy, The New Rules of Breakthrough Collaboration. And once you discover Lee, by the way, you'll head over to check out her book, Making the Team. It's in its fifth or sixth edition, I think, at this point. The single best book I've ever read on team development. And yes, Wally, it's beyond that book, Team of Teams, that I know you like and I don't love so much.
Okay. I don't know Lee Thompson. Mm-hmm. So give me the one thing that should make me pick that book up.
The one thing, gosh, if you're working with a group and your goal is to generate ideas, she provides a framework and a set of guidelines you can follow that will optimize that group's ability to generate ideas. And they're really simple tactics. So for example, she's, you know, the research shows that if you want to generate a good idea, generate a lot of ideas. So she's all about setting time constraints and sprinting maximum number of ideas, and then striving for a statistical improvement in the number of ideas in the next sprint and so forth. It's just ideas like that that take the bias and the politics out of what goes on in so many meeting rooms everywhere, where the boss says something and everybody nods their heads and that's suddenly the idea, or the quiet people, the introverted types, are fearful of speaking up.
And I suppose, or the people who are from cultures where speaking up is considered pushy and you don't do it.
Or they're afraid of sharing what they think will be perceived as a dumb idea, and there's social pressures in there. So I'm going to come back at a more direct answer to your question is, I think that she's the foremost expert on using nominal group techniques, individualized brainstorming, and then bringing it together with groups to create more value than just what we normally do, which is, hey, let's run a little brainstorming session there.
Okay. Can you elucidate what nominal group techniques means?
Yeah. It means let people think through and brainstorm and ideate on their own first. So for example, a simple example is you want to get together with a group to brainstorm on a particular problem you're trying to solve, come up with the ideas. Frame the question carefully, and Lee has some great guidance on how to frame questions. Give it to people ahead of time, the night before. Ask them to generate as many ideas as they can. Ask them to give them back to you and post them, for example, on the whiteboard or flip charts without attribution at the beginning of the session. And then you get quickly into a mode where people can jump and build on those ideas. You're also less apt to have those social pressures and the biases and the people who are fearful of raising their ideas in there. So that's, yeah, that's that fancy phrase. I'll qualify. So some may read this book and say, okay, it's kind of an academic perspective in some of the reviews. No doubt about it. It's research-backed. It's science-backed. Yet it's eminently practical if you look, you know, beyond the research to the recommendations.
Sounds like another book I'm going to have to buy.
Good Kindle read, good one to own if you're you're working with clients on identifying ideas for books and solving problems around it. You very, very, very well enjoy some of Lee's advice here.
And you know, I have the benefit of having read a bunch of that research because I helped put together a course in innovation and creativity years ago for one of the giant oil companies our land. And that gave me a chance to dig into the research. So it's interesting to go back and then see how other people have also used it. I work with authors all the time. Mm-hmm. And they want to say, well, let's brainstorm a little bit. Let's throw some ideas back and forth. And let's say, no, you go write down a bunch of them. And then when you come back, we'll talk about it.
Right, there you go. Not that good technique. Look, I mean, ideas are the fuel for innovation in our world today. And we have to innovate or die, as the cliche goes, but there's truth to it. And if this gives you some good ideas on how to do a better job generating more ideas, well, it's well worth the time and the application, the investment.
Okay, if I'm the boss, the rank in the room.
Right.
As it were, is this going to give me a way to take some of the effect of rank in the room out?
Heck yes. Yes, absolutely, unequivocally.
See.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, I believe that's a reason to buy the book.
There you go. Nice distillation, Wally. So we had wanted to kind of cap us off, and I'd love for you to cap us off again on why we should reread these great books. So why don't you help us tie things together here?
I'll give it a shot. We reread books because we don't get enough from them the first time. Mm-hmm. And great books speak to you for years. We just talked about two books here. One of them was written in 1983. The other in 1966 were my picks. And I'm not sure what yours were, Art. But
yeah, Creative Conspiracy was 2013. Rumelt's probably circa that timing as well. I don't know for sure, but in that neighborhood.
Okay, so I mean, we're years away from it. There's thousands of books coming out every year. Most of them are crap. Some of them are good. A few are excellent, but it's hard to pick them out right away. But if you're going out, you gave us one of the best examples. I'm going to do this kind of problem. I know that Rumelt writes about this. I know that she writes about this. So I'm going to just check first and prime my pump so I'm ready when I get there. That's why we reread. And sometimes we reread all the way through. More often, we reread notes, we go back to specific parts, and we take stuff out.
Well said, Wally. What I feel when I'm hitting these books again, and again, Rumelt's Good Strategy, Bad Strategy, in anticipation of an engagement, it's like extra just oxygen to the brain. I feel so good reading the. He reminds me that we need to distill to make it simple, to achieve, strive for clarity. He reminds me of what bad strategy looks like, which is what most people are practicing out there. And it's exhilarating. So yeah, I mean, I'd like to come back to it over and over. When you find a book that does that for you, come back to it, put it on the bookshelf, own it, read it, own it three or four times as you did with the effect.
Own it three or four times. Yes. Let me point out one other thing. I want to distill something that you said. is when I listen to your two explanations of the books that you like, they have one thing in common: framework. Mm. You like authors, and I like authors too, but you're the one who said it. You like authors who give you a framework so that you're not tied to the specific case they talk about.
Yes.
You can take Rummelt's Kernel and go into any strategy room and teach it to the people in the room in about 5 minutes, and then use it to evaluate all kinds of things: profit, nonprofit, big, little, short term, long term, whatever.
You know, that is so well said, and I wish I would have thought of that. I have to highlight a little anecdote here if we have one more minute. A few years ago, I had the great chance to catch up with Jeffrey Moore. Jeffrey Moore, in my mind, is one of those Silicon Valley, you know, strategy heroes out there, and it was really humbling to be able to talk with him. And as we talked about his book, Escape Velocity, I challenged him. Who am I to challenge Jeffrey Moore? And I challenged him to say that, you know, Jeffrey, you've given us, in his words, a framework of frameworks, but it's not the only framework I need to use in helping my clients or helping my firm develop strategy. I can draw upon Rummelt's approach. I can draw upon other types and templates and tools. They're all tools to look at a problem from different angles. And you know what? He didn't disagree at all. I was really gratified that he jumped on that.
Yeah, you thought it might be a really dumb thing to say,
like
brainstorming session. Should I share this?
That's one of those moments when your mouth is talking and your brain is thinking, "Hey, you're arguing with Jeffrey Moore. You're an idiot, Art."
Yeah. Are you sure you want to keep doing this? Can I reel that one back in?
Yeah. Well, listen, Wally,
that is a great story.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, and I was so gratified by how he dealt with it. Well, this was as always, just tremendous fun. So thank you for spending time here today. Thanks for your great recommendations. Thanks for putting up with me. And I can't wait till we talk again.
Me too.
All right. Take care, my friend.
Take care.